That is pretty remarkable music, isn't it? And with us, the man who chose that, Judge Dean Mildren. Thanks for being with us, Judge.
Yeah, thanks, Annie.
And why that piece in particular?
Well, I just loved it. I regularly listen to the ABC's classical morning program, mm-hmm. and usually when I'm driving to work. And one morning I heard it being played, and I just loved it. And the announcer called it That Piece, and I wondered what on earth the name of it was. Yeah. So when I got into the office, I asked my secretary to chase it down and buy me a copy of it, which he did. And that got me very interested in the composer, Charles Litolf. His actual name was Henry Charles Litolf, who was quite an interesting character.
Mm-hmm.
He ended up spending some time in jail, and he was an Englishman born in London.
Yeah, how long ago?
Well, he was born in 1818, and he sort of lived between 1818 and 1891. And he escaped from jail with the aid of his jailer.
Yeah.
And went to live in the Netherlands, and eventually moved to Brussels, where he purchased a music publishing business. And he became very famous as a music publisher. Still, a lot of his stuff is available as a publisher. But he was a great pianist as well as a composer.
Do you know what he was in jail for?
I think it was just debt.
Oh, rightio. Fair enough. Not too disgraceful. Was it stuff, music like that inspired you to play originally, and still play? You still play piano,
yes,
don't you?
Yes, that's right. Well, it was. I just love the piano. We of course had a piano at home, and I think all the neighbours had pianos. And when I was quite small, I'd just sit there for hours banging away, and my grandmother, who was a music teacher, decided that I should learn, but she didn't teach me. I went off and got teaching from somebody else, and that's where it went for a bit.
Now, tell us a little bit about your childhood. You grew up in a very loving family, I understand, but humble digs. You lived in an extended family.
Yes. Well, see, my grandmother owned a house that her father had built and gave to her, because her father was quite wealthy at one stage. But she was a widow, and then she had three young children to bring up, and it was all Depression years and so mm-hmm. forth. So when the war was over, of course I was born during the war, my parents were still living in the house, and that's where I was raised. And I was still there until my grandmother died when I was 16.
Well, it wasn't necessarily all that humble. Was it a lovely big old thing?
Was it
beautiful house?
Oh, yes, it was
house?
Quite a nice big house.
Yeah, yeah. And Dad was a bootmaker or a shoemaker?
Well, that was his trade.
Yeah.
But when I was growing up, he'd already become a manager of a shoe store, so he'd graduated somewhat.
Did he teach you how to mend shoes, though?
Well, I certainly saw how it was done, because shoe mending was actually done on the premises. And my father did it. He employed others to do that. So I used to go up there and watch them do it.
Mm. Yeah, well, it's very hard to find a cobbler these days, isn't it?
Mm.
Very, very difficult to find one. You continued to play piano then as a young fella, branched out into pop music for a little while.
That's right. Well, I got sick of playing classical music, particularly as my teacher wanted me to memorise everything.
Mm.
And so I thought I'd like to play pop music, which I did for I went and got trained in pop music for a year. And then the teacher said to me one day, well, I can't teach you anymore. And I really didn't want to give up going to her lessons. So I noticed she had a beautiful piano in another section of the room. I said, well, what's that over there? She said, oh, that's my classical piano. I said, well, why don't we do some classics then? So I stayed on for another two or three years doing classical training.
Now, come clean. Were you a bit partial to the teacher?
Not really.
Not
I
really?
Mean, I mean, she's a lovely lady, but she was into her 60s and half her hair was falling out.
Radio. But she did have a beautiful piano.
But she did,
that
yes.
You couldn't keep your hands off.
No.
And you've continued to play.
Yes.
Just for enjoyment. Did you ever consider, you know, making a career of it?
Well, when I sort of in my mid to late teens, it was an option that I was thinking about. But I got very interested in debating and acting, and law. I had an uncle who was involved in the law, and he persuaded me that that was where I should go, and that's what I did.
So that inspired you to go off and do your degree. Mm. Was it hard for you, or were you always an academic sort of a fella?
Well, no, I didn't find it at all hard. Mm. I'd won a scholarship, so my parents couldn't have afforded to have sent me to university. Mm. Without it, were able to get by on the scholarship.
So how long after you graduated did you come up here?
Oh, well, I was admitted in 1968, and we moved here permanently in January 1972.
That's you and your wife?
Yeah.
And I hear you didn't leave home until you got married. How about that? Home must have been pretty nice.
Well, it was, and there was no reason to go looking for other digs.
So up here in 1972, tell us a little bit about what it was like then, the legal scene. It was, from what I gather, it was pretty exciting, and there was a whole lot of you guys who got involved in acting and all that sort of stuff.
Well, that's right. I didn't actually get involved in acting because when I came up here to live, I was really far too busy to, mm-hmm. to get it, and the theatre company here was rehearsing three nights a week, and I just couldn't do that. But people like Tom Pauling got involved,
and Ken Conway
and others. So far as the legal scene was concerned, there were only about four or five firms, and most of the litigation was done by the same people, you know. I think there might have been about half a dozen of us.
Did you hang out together?
Oh, no, not. We did it on Friday afternoons, yes. Yeah. We all made our way to that Italian restaurant in Nucky Street. Yeah. And so Friday afternoon was a complete write-off. In fact, we'd have lunch there, and then after lunch, Ben Ean Mazel was the big drink in those days. We get locked in. The proprietor would go home and we'd still be there drinking, and we'd just help ourselves to everything and leave the empty bottles on
there
and just write him a cheque for the amount. And we'd be often still there when he came back at night.
The good old days, eh? Mm. When you could sort of... Well, people did that on a Friday afternoon, didn't they?
Yes.
Friday was a write-off. People went out, they worked hard in the morning, went out for lunch and, you know, maybe came back to the office to pick up their keys or something and probably drive home.
Well, that's very likely. So I mean, it was the days of short pants and long socks.
And safari suits,
yes, that's true.
Now, tell us about the reasons you came up here. Was it because you knew that there was an opportunity to start up a firm, or did you know people up here?
Well, I was a partner in a large firm in Adelaide, and the firm had established a branch office in Darwin in the late 60s. I'd come up in 69, 70 for a few months to mind the office while Ken Conway and Brian, oh gosh, what was his other name? I'll think of it in a minute.
Yeah, later.
Went on holidays, and I quite enjoyed it. I had a good time, and anyway, there's a bit of a story here. Brian decided he wanted to become a magistrate, and the partners couldn't find a partner who was prepared to come and live in Darwin. I just certainly didn't want to go as a partner. And they tried to sell the practice. Nobody wanted it, so there was a big partners meeting one day, and one of the partners said in exasperation, "We can't give it away. We can't sell it. We might as well give it away." And I said, "Well, if you're going to give it away, I'll have it."
Yeah.
So they knew then that they had a buyer, and I ended up buying it.
But you got a good deal.
Oh, yes, I got a good deal.
You got a good deal. Yeah. Now, look, your book's called Big Boss Fella, All Same Judge. I haven't had a chance to have a read yet, but it certainly does give us a bit of an idea of the sort of stuff you're covering. You know, you're talking about, to some extent anyhow, having a sort of European or, sorry, English legal system here in the Territory and how that worked, you know, in the really early days, but also, I suppose, in relatively recent days, you know, flying out to court and all that sort of stuff.
That's right. Well, it's very true. The tyranny of distance in the territory brought about a number of really strange things. For example, there was no road from Darwin to Alice Springs until one was built during World War II. That meant that we couldn't send a judge to sit in Alice Springs until 1935, and they had to sort of build a courthouse, or actually they had adapted a building which was used for other purposes into a courthouse, and the judge and his staff flew from the end of the railway line at Larimar to Alice Springs, and this was the first time members of court had actually flown anywhere to attend a circuit court. So that became a bit of a first for Australia, and flew all the way back to Darwin on the return trip. And I think it took 12 hours all up.
Gee, that was in the really early days.
Yeah, 1935.
What about when you came? You would have gone out and done bush court, wouldn't you?
Yes, I didn't do a great deal of that. I certainly went down to Katherine about once a fortnight. Mm-hmm. I'd drive down there and do work in the Katherine court. But I personally didn't go to the bush courts myself. I don't know who did.
So what area of law did you focus on?
Well, basically, I did everything, but the main part of my practice in those days was personal injuries work, mostly for insurance companies.
You did, though, tell us a little bit about a yarn, you know, travelling out. Were you working for the NLC at some stage?
Yes, that's right. Well, what happened was my firm came to represent the Northern Land Council during the Ranger negotiations and the subsequent Narbarlek negotiations. And when the Northern Land Council was taking instructions from the traditional owners about whether they wanted to enter into the draft agreement that had been prepared and negotiated, we had to go out. I had to go out and be there to explain to the people any aspects of the agreement they wanted explained to them.
Mm-hmm.
So we were flown out in a light aircraft to a base, basically Aunt Pelly, and then there was a meeting that was held, I think it was at Red Lily Lagoon, I'm not sure now. But essentially, we would stay there all day, sitting under a tree, waiting for the nod to come over and, you know, answer any questions.
Yeah, well, how difficult was that for you to translate legalese into very simple, comprehensible English especially, I suppose, for people for whom English was like a third or fourth language?
Well, we spent a lot of time doing just that, because there had been a complaint made that the contract hadn't been reduced into a document that was understandable.
Mm.
So we did actually spend a lot of time trying to express it in simple language that would be understandable to Aboriginal people who spoke a little English.
Do you reckon that that's an issue, though, across the board for people who are outside of the legal system to understand what's going on? You know, I mean, there's been a lot of controversy over the last few years, certainly write-ups in the media and stories in the media about the general public, in essence, the general public not necessarily understanding how the system works, you know, feeling like, you know, we're not getting justice, that victims don't get justice, etc.
Well, there's definitely an aspect to that, and for example, if I can sort of briefly talk about two aspects of it.
Mm-hmm.
The first aspect of it are those people whose English capabilities are inadequate to understand the proceedings. They might be able to speak reasonable English at a conversational level, but not really be able to cope with the concepts and words that are likely to be used in a court setting, even when giving evidence. So they need to have interpreters. And with Aboriginal languages, until the 1990s, there was no interpreter service, so getting interpreters was a real difficulty. That's all thankfully changed for the better, and is getting better all the time. So there's that side of it. But then there are people who speak perfectly good English and have had a good, reasonably good education, who don't fully understand the system. And we're trying to cope with that by our website. We put a lot of information on our website about, for example, the principles that are involved in sentencing. There's a whole section of the website that deals with that. And that's intended to explain to the public that, you know, how a judge goes about sentencing, the sort of factors that are taken into account.
Yeah, because I've actually heard, you know, when people sort of cry for blood in the general public, when they actually get an opportunity to be on a pretendee jury or a real jury, they are often a lot more sympathetic to the
exactly.
To the accused.
There've been a couple of studies done on that. One was a quite detailed study in Tasmania. I think it involved something like 1,000 different jurors over an extended period, who were questioned about what they thought of the sentence that was imposed in relation to the case that they actually sat on, the results of that indicated that the jurors thought the sentence was either right or more than what they themselves would have given. Play models, we've had situations where we've had maybe, you know, 50 or 60 people turn up, actors have played the role of the accused and the prosecutor and the defence counsel, and there's been a judge such as myself presiding, and there's been a script as to what the facts are, and submissions are made, and then the audience are asked to consider what sentence they would hand down, and the judge also does the same thing, and then subsequently the results are compared. Usually the results have shown in the past that the judge, if anything, is slightly more tough
than the jury.
Than the public.
So do you reckon it is? It's media mischief, do you think?
No, not necessarily. The media are out for stories, so they're not going. They're not really going to be terribly interested in reporting a sentence which is hasn't got any news
controversy.
Value.
Yeah.
So a harsh sentence is unlikely to get reported. A sentence that's sort of middle of the road is not going to get reported. It's only the odd one which the reporter or the editor thinks is far too low that attracts attention. So you get the impression, if that's all you read about the court, that we're a lot of
softies. Look, just moving away from the law, though, I know you had a few hairy plane trips when you were doing work out bush, but I heard about an incredibly hair-raising adventure you had in China. Tell us about that.
Well, yes. Well, I was on a tour of China with a number of other lawyers and a couple of judges as well, and we flew to Beijing, and from there to we were supposed to go to Kunming, which is right down in the Himalayas, and so we're on this flight. It was an old British Trident jet, and your sort of knees are up under your chin, and about halfway along the trip. It was supposed to be about a four-hour flight. I said to Liz, my wife, I said, don't look now, but this plane is descending. And she said, oh, no, of course it's not. I said, yes, I think it is. And then 5 minutes later, they announced that there was bad weather in Kunming and we were going to be landing at Chongqing. And Chongqing is in sort of western China over near Tibet. And it was the old wartime capital of the nationalist Chinese. So we land there, it's raining, it's a terrible day, and it's misty, and mountains everywhere, and we're stuck on the tarmac, and the pilot got out with the engineer and the screwdriver in their hand, and they got a set of steps and climbed onto the wing and opened the cap to the motor and started fiddling with it. I said to Liz, I think you'd better have an asthma attack because we're going to be here forever.
Yeah.
And so she did. She put on this great performance, and the flight attendants got worried, and so eventually we were allowed to go into the terminus while they fixed the plane up, which took hours.
Yeah.
It was about 5 or 6 hours. And they took us to lunch, and then some of the delegates decided that they weren't prepared to get back on the plane, and they were...
Because it was looked a bit dodgy.
Yeah, and so they were trying to catch train, and the people heard about this, so we were all gathered together and marched onto the plane at Bayonet Point.
Bayonet Point.
Bayonet Point, yeah. we weren't going anywhere. And when we arrived in Kunming, it was a beautiful day. Hadn't rained for ages.
So it wasn't the weather at all. It was a dodgy plane. But the trip, the rest of the trip was okay, was it?
Well, the rest of the trip was fine, except for the fact that I got lost in Kunming. We were part of the tour was to take us to the zoo to see the pandas, and I was very excited to want to see the pandas. So we were bused to the zoo and then told to be at the gates at 5 o'clock, and the bus would be there to pick us up. Anyway, my wife didn't come. She didn't want to go or wasn't well or something. And so I was with another lawyer, and we just wandered around looking at all the things in the zoo, and got back at the gate at exactly 5 o'clock, only to find that we were the last people in the zoo. The bus had been and gone, and there wasn't a soul in sight, and there was no taxis, and what's more, wouldn't know a taxi.
This was a fair while ago, wasn't it?
Oh, this was 1983.
Yeah.
And all the signs were in Chinese, and so we had no idea where we were, and we just started walking, and we eventually ended up in the old central part of the city, the original central part.
Mm.
And it was still daylight, and we saw eventually saw a couple of people heading our way who appeared to be blonde-headed, and they had a map, and they were up to
and that was
us.
It?
Well, it wasn't entirely. It meant that we sort of headed in the right direction and still got no idea where our hotel was. And eventually we stopped outside of a school and thought, oh, these girls seem to be coming out of school. Maybe we can find someone here who speaks English. And anyway, I went up to this group of young girls and tried talking to them, but they all dissolved in giggles. And so I drew out a little map of the Green Lake and the hotel and all the trees around it and showed them. And they all again dissolved in giggles. And the next thing, we started walking again, and we got up to an intersection. There was an old man sitting on a bicycle with one of those funny hats on, and he pointed the way to go which street to take. So we followed his directions, and we got up another few streets, and there was the same man sitting on the bicycle pointing the way at the...
Oh, really?
Yes, and this happened about three times.
Isn't that
until
great?
We got back to the hotel.
Fantastic. Now, we're going to have to say goodbye soon, Judge, but you obviously absolutely love the Northern Territory. You've been here now for 40 years or something.
Mm-hmm.
What is it about the place?
Oh, I just love it. You know, I love everything about it. I love the people. I love the laid-back nature of the people, its casualness and so on. I used to love the fact that the law was sort of pretty easy and not complicated, and not too intrusive.
Mm.
But I'm afraid that I'm becoming a little bit more cynical in my old age, and I worry about the extent to which we're becoming a nanny state and being over controlled by regulation.
Which is something that I think a lot of people would share with you. It's been an absolute joy having you in the studio. Big Boss Fella, All Same Judge is a great big book all about the history of the law in the Territory, white fella law anyhow. Congratulations on that. I understand that when you, if and when you hang up that wig, you're going to focus a little bit more on writing and continuing to play beautiful piano.
Thanks, Ellie.
Lovely to have you. And this this piece that we're going out with?
Liszt's Etude in G minor, number 3, one of my favourites. It's just beautiful. Thank you.